This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and I'm joined by Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you have a question, be it big or small, about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll be exploring this special topic.
From catnaps to all-out snoozing, we're going to talk about sleeping in the animal kingdom. A little later, we'll find out whether animals experience sleep the same way we do and why some animals don't need a whole lot of sleep at all.
I need a lot. We'll also welcome an animal photographer to the show to talk about her experiences working with some of the most exceptional mixed breeds in the country. And that's still to come later on in the show. First, let's take some calls at 1-800-462-7413. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Beth from Rockville, Maryland.
Hi, Beth. Thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
We're interested in rescuing a second dog for a companion for our first dog and to expand our family. So our question is how do we go about choosing a second dog?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's a question that deserves to be looked at thoughtfully. I'm afraid so many people go out and just sort of get another dog.
Yeah.
You know, the first question to ask is whether your first dog really, really does want a second dog. Does your dog love to play with other dogs?
One-on-one. She does well one-on-one. In a big group, she tends to stay off to the side. But when we go for a walk in our neighborhood, she'll go to different houses for friends to go visiting.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's a good sign right there. That's a good sign. Well, and then the questions really go to you in terms of what do you want? I mean, one of the hardest questions for people like me to answer, and it's one of the most common questions we get, is what dog should I get? You know, what dog is the best dog for me? Well, I don't know you. And so there's some very generic kinds of advice, which is usually if you have a male dog, you're better off getting a female dog or vice versa. That's sort of the generic. If you have a dog who's a really hard player, plays really sort of rough and tough like some dogs do, some boxers can play really rough and tough, some of the terriers play really rough and tough, you want to get another rough, tough player.
So the opposites don't work there.
Well said, Larry. The opposites do not work there. But other questions really are more about what do you want? Do you want two big dogs? Do you want another little, you know, do you like symmetry? Or do you want variants? So what kind of dog do you have now?
Dolly's a terrier mix, probably poodle, terrier, some pointer. She's about 20 pounds. She's got a lot of personality.
Yeah, that's good. It sounds like you really like her.
Yeah, I love Dolly.
So would you like four of them? Because if you get another dog like her, it's not like having two.
It's like having four?
It's exponential. It's like having four. Would you like that same kind of personality?
I'd probably like a little bit different, because she can be very, very, very independent thinking. And two independent thinking dogs, I think, would be pretty hard.
And this is very, very, very good. You're absolutely right. Two independent dogs make a pack. And then so you might want to think about, you know, pointers were bred to work quite independently, and they're famous for that, and that's what they need to be. You might want to think about getting one of the dogs, maybe one of the hunting breeds of the, like the Labrador Golden kind of variety, or maybe a herding kind of a dog, who mix, perhaps, who was bred to work with you, or maybe even a lap kind of dog who wants to just sort of hang around with you, but would love to play every once in a while with your terrier. So keep all those things in mind.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we heard from a listener named Ann, whose dog recently came down with an ear infection that had to be treated with ointment in his ear. At first, when Ann tried to apply the ointment, her dog became violent and would snap at her, and as a result, Ann purchased a muzzle. When she put it on him, it suddenly became as if he'd been tranquilized, and Ann could do anything she wanted. So Ann wants to know, why did the muzzle have such a surprising effect on her dog? That is interesting.
Isn't it interesting? And I've seen that many, many times. And it's not just the muzzle. There's a body harness you can use on dogs that most dogs pay absolutely no attention to, but every once in a while you put it on a dog or you put a head halter on them and they just freeze. They just go really quiet. And we're not exactly sure, but there's, as always, you know, PhDs are about speculating and coming up with possibilities. And so one possibility is it's a kind of a shock. You know, there's a behavior called tonic immobility where an animal just freezes, and basically it's because they're in a kind of shock. They're so scared that they're just frozen. But there's another reason, a sort of more benevolent reason why I think muzzles quiet dogs and get them immobile. We know that one of the ways that higher status dogs, or really I'm thinking of wolf packs particularly, but dogs also will discipline other dogs and sort of exert their authority, is to do an inhibited muzzle bite. And so the older dog will gently bite the muzzle of another dog and just squeeze a little bit, and the dog goes still. So there's a possibility that the pressure of the muzzle replicates that feeling, and it just causes the dog to just stand still.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
If people have questions for us, how do they email us?
Oh, it's just really easy. It's just the easiest thing in the world. You just send us an email to pets. You can remember that. Hey, pets,
pets@wpr.org. And you can join us by phone at 1-800-462-7413, and somebody's done just that. So let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is John Harvey in Bartlesville, Oklahoma.
Hi, John. Thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, my dog Pepper has a nipping problem. When I walk him or when we have a visitor at the house, when he first encounters somebody new, if he's on the leash, he'll just kind of hide behind me.
Mm.
And then after, let's say we're conversing, he'll go up behind him and nip him on the hind end. And
your neighbors aren't liking that?
No.
No?
And it's progressing from just a mild nip when my son used to get it coming home from college, or now my daughter, to where he's acting a little more aggressive, too.
That's not good.
It's not good, and I'd like to nip this problem.
Yeah, very
in
good.
Nip it in the bud. Not in the butt.
Careful, Larry. Well, I'm glad you called, because this is something that could escalate into something much more serious.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you shared that observation, that his first response is to hide behind you. So what he's telling us is that he's afraid. He's afraid of unfamiliar people. That's very common in dogs. Neophobia, or the fear of unfamiliar things, is very common in many, many dogs. And so that nip is happening after he gets a little bit of confidence, just enough confidence to sort of act on his fears. You know, we don't normally think of shy as being aggressive, but, you know, think of the hermit in the hut in the desert who gets the gun out when you drive up. You know? So what I would suggest you do, first of all, with any kind of problem of this potential seriousness, you'd be great to find somebody in your area who knows how to use counter-classical conditioning. And that's the question to ask. If you're calling around for trainers, I would advise against somebody who just punishes him. Because that's going to take away the warning. But it's not going to take away the reason for it. You know, I don't want you to treat the symptoms. I want you to treat the cause. And the cause is his fear and his discomfort. So counter-classical conditioning involves a situation where you create events where Chopper's on a leash and can't possibly hurt anybody. But people come not too close to him, just close enough to toss some food to him, and then they walk away. So you're going to call your neighbors, and you're going to hand out little bags of wonderful food and make it really good food. I mean, make it like cut-up chicken and stuff. So Chapper's like, whoa.
Good stuff.
What happened here? When I see somebody walk up to me and my guy at the mailbox, I'm going to get chicken. And he gets all happy rather than getting scared. But the trick is to go slowly with this. Most people go too far too fast. So that's why I want you to check in with a professional. Go online. There's some books about how to handle this kind of problem. Be sure to learn how to deal with this before you jump in. But that's the gist of it, is change his emotions when somebody unfamiliar walks up.
And good luck, and thanks very much for calling. You know, Patricia, we get a variety of questions and a variety of tips from people. And we have one from Heather in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. I think that's kind of interesting. She says she had trouble with her huskies sneaking up on moose when they were out ski-jarring.
Well, now that's a problem we have down here a lot in Madison also, often.
Her main concern, and this was a big concern, was surprising a moose when it's in the woods or on a trail, since moose can be aggressive. So.
Oh, they can kill dogs. I mean, many dogs have actually been killed by moose.
Well, and Heather could be in trouble herself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Heather.
Well, Heather's solution was to put bells on her dogs' collars, and with jingle bells on their necks, the dogs can't sneak up on anything. That's a good tip, isn't it?
It's a great tip. And, you know, I was just on a walk with some wonderful people in Ann Arbor, Michigan last week, and one of the dogs, who was a little bit of a wanderer in the woods, had a bell on him, and it was a great way to always know where he was. So that's a great tip.
And if people want to send us a pet tip, they can do it by...
Oh, keep them coming. Just send us a pet tip by email to pets@wpr.org.
And you can join us by phone at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll explore the topic of sleep and how some animals can get by without any sleep at all. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time to take a look at this week's topic. And Patricia, we know that humans have to sleep in order to function properly. I certainly do. And
ditto.
Yeah, we're going to maintain good health. But is sleep really necessary for other animals?
Well, you know, it's a great question. We know in humans that sleep-deprived people can't make good judgments. We lose coordination.
Right.
I mean, we can't function at all. You know, our minds just can't manage without sleep. But we don't know if this is true with other animals. We know that although we have to sleep, there's some animals that don't, they don't need much sleep at all. Horses, for example, they only sleep 3 hours a day.
Wow. That's amazing for an animal that needs so much strength and energy.
Yeah, you'd think they need to rest up. But, you know, they're not the only large animal that can go without a lot of sleep. Orca whale mothers and their newborn calves, get this, Larry, they don't sleep for over a month. A month after the calf is born.
Well, I didn't sleep for about a month after Emily was born. But, no, I got
I'm
some
sure
sleep.
I'm sure it felt like that.
It felt like it. Why do they need to be awake that long?
Well, we don't really know. What we do know is that there's a tremendous amount of predation pressure. And
so we
think whale mothers need to stay awake, literally, to protect their young from predators. And two, they need to stay awake to help their babies learn how to regulate their breathing. You know, if the little baby forgets to breathe, they're going to drown. So that's probably one of the reasons.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, but it also makes me think about other sea life. What about fish? I'm a fisherman. Do fish sleep at all?
Well, your guess is as good as ours. We have no idea if fish sleep or not. I mean, you don't come in and see your little goldfish, you know,
laying on its
flat
side.
On its side in the sand in the bottom of the tank. But we do know some interesting things about animals who live underwater. This is a mammal, but dolphins have a really interesting way of sleeping. They actually sleep with one side of their brain at a time. So they alternate. One half is asleep, the other half is awake, and they even close the opposite eye. So if their right-hand side of their brain is asleep, their left eye is closed.
You know, that sounds like some of the students in the classes I teach when I'm lecturing.
Well, if half their brain's awake, you're not doing badly sometimes.
Do animals experience sleep the same way we do? Take things like rapid eye movement, for example.
Yeah, that's a really good question because it's so important in human sleep, right? You know, we know that if you don't get that REM, rapid eye movement sleep, you're not going to be able to function. And we know particularly that the areas of the brain involved in learning are very busy during rapid eye movement sleep. So we think there's some kind of connection there. We also know that almost all mammals and birds experience REM sleep, but reptiles and amphibians don't. So there's an appearance that sleep might have something to do with learning. We see it in animals with complex brains whose behavior is dependent on learning rather than just instinct.
So all in all, why is sleep so important to us in the animal kingdom?
Because it feels so good, Larry. It's just so good. But beyond that, why does it feel good, right? Well, it's a great mystery. You know, there are a lot of people who believe that the main function of sleep in humans anyway is long-term memory formation, you know, something about processing all that learning. But the research on sleep is ambiguous at best. You know, it's really quite a mystery. There's another view, by the way, which I thought was really interesting about why animals sleep, which is that sleep actually evolved as a mechanism to keep animals safe at night. You know, it's dangerous out there, right?
Keeps me out of view of the boogeyman. You know?
Yeah, but he's still under the bed, Larry. But, you know, for a lot of the animals who sleep, it can be very dangerous at night. And this is a way to sort of force an animal to settle down, stay quiet, and out of the view of predators.
Makes good sense to me.
One possibility anyway, but got to keep that boogeyman under the bed for Larry.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Rob from Tallahassee, Florida. I'm calling about something I'm sure you guys have talked about many times, but I have a 6-year-old male Pekingese who's been neutered, and he has started to mark everywhere in my house, and I just would like to know, is there any way I can stop that dog?
Oh, there probably is. There probably is. The longer it's been going on, the harder it'll be. It's like any habit, you know, the longer a habit is established, the more work you have to get it turned around. But I would do a couple of things. First of all, I would pretend he's a puppy. I know he's 6 years old, but I want you to treat him like a little puppy, and I want you to go outside with the best treats in the world, something that's going to get him like, whoa, I don't know what changed, but I like it. Take him where he tends to go to the bathroom. Let him lift his leg. It helps sometimes to put it on cue, so when he's about to go, say, hurry up, or, you know, do your business, or say something. He lifts his leg, he finishes, and you say right there, and you should be standing right beside him. Don't be at the porch. Be right beside him. So he gets a treat right after his little leg comes down. Good boy, and he gets a treat, and he's like, boy, I don't know. Dad's pretty stupid. He's giving me chicken for going to the bathroom, but he's going outside. And so you're going to reinforce him for going outside. So that's part of it. Now there's the what to do about the going in the house part.
Mm-hmm.
One is you have to make sure you get rid of the odors. So wherever he has gone, and you might want to rent a black light. Sometimes you can rent those from pet stores because it will show urine up as a sort of a purple
is that
glow.
Right?
Yep, sort of a purple glow, and it really helps you know where he actually has gone. You know, sometimes it's obvious, but sometimes it's not so obvious. You know how good their noses are.
Yeah.
And I want you to treat that area with an enzymatic product that breaks down the molecules in urine that makes it smell like urine. Because if he can smell urine in the house, then he's going to cover it up again. He's going to freshen it up, right? Oh, that smell's starting to fade away. You know, they identify bathrooms based on smell. We do it on sight. They do it on smell. So you've got to eliminate the odor. That's one thing. Second of all, you're going to treat him like a little puppy, and you're not going to give him a lot of freedom to go have a, quote, accident. I love that term. I drop my urine. You know? I want you to keep him with you. Keep him on a leash if you have to. Keep the door shut. Don't give him a chance to make a mistake. If he does start to lift his leg in the house when you see him, I want you to best thing to do would be to, throw a paperback book beside him, not at him. Clap your hands, slap the wall, do something to startle him out of it. So, you know, you're not trying to scare him. I don't want him to think I can't do this in front of Dad or else he won't go to the bathroom outside with you.
Yeah.
I just want him to get startled, like, oh, what, and stop, and then you take him outside. But, and you can even, if he does it when you're not around, which is really common, you could actually set him up. And I did this to one of my female dogs. I actually hid in a closet. I sat down with a paperback book, and she was going in a bedroom upstairs, and I crept up the stairs, and I sat down in the closet with a paperback book, and I waited. Didn't have to wait too long, luckily, about half an hour, and she comes creeping up the stairs, and she goes in the guest bedroom. She just about started to squat, and I threw my paperback right beside her. And if you could have seen her eyes, it was like, how did she get there? You know, how did that happen? She never did it again. So those are the three things I want you to do inside. And that package ought to get that problem turned around.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Rob, for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's the number for you to call to join in, 1-800-462-7413. and let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Patricia. How are you?
Just fine. Who are we speaking with?
You're speaking with Bill in lovely Charlotte County, Florida.
Well, Bill, it's a pleasure to talk with you. And what can we do for you?
We're talking weasels.
Oh.
Or
Ooh.
Ferrets.
Ferrets.
I have a couple questions about them. My girlfriend has had ferrets for over 20 years, and she's a big friend of ferrets.
Mm-hmm.
But, folks, these are stinky little critters. They're beautiful. They're lots of fun to watch. They're entertaining. But is there some way that perhaps changing their diet could change their smell? And also, I have a question on whether or not, and unfortunately here in Florida, we're very warm. Around 95 is the top that we're going to have today. Can we keep them out on the lanai or area, perhaps, with a misting system to drop the ambient air temperature?
That's a really good question. And, I don't know enough about your lanai, and I don't know exactly what the temperature is like. You know, and the truth of the matter is, I don't know what temperature range really is either optimum or much less acceptable, you know, mm-hmm. for ferrets. But I would imagine if they were in the shade, particularly if there was a breeze, and then you had some kind of a cooling system where you had a misting system, that probably would be all right. I would think that would probably be all right.
Are they normally stinky creatures?
You know, I have never heard anybody say that. So I don't know if he's talking about, I should ask you, are you talking about their body odor or are you talking about their feces?
I'm talking about their body odor and their feces. They're fed a regular mix specifically formulated for ferrets. Mm-hmm. And if you give them, they like to have little treats like cat food, sends them over the top. they'll ignore the ferret feed and go sure. right after the cat's dish as soon as possible. There's three of them. They're very social.
They are meat eaters. And, you know, they are the Mustelids, mm-hmm. they are in a group of animals that do have these scent glands that can get pretty mm-hmm. strong. You know, that's where must came from. I have a question for you. I think this is the bottom line question, really. Does she think they smell bad?
Well, yes.
Ah.
I mean, she keeps them in an interior room,
yeah.
but, you know, you can open that front door and, you know, as you walk into someone's house and you go, oh, they've got cats. Well, this is like catch time.
Oh, 10. They have ferrets.
Mm.
Well, you know,
yeah.
I think this is a great question for our listeners. I think this is
perfect.
I would love to hear from our listeners who have ferrets about whether there is a ferret odor that is real strong enough to be, I mean, obviously there's a ferret odor, but is it so strong that when you walk in the house, you smell it? And if so, what you've done about it? Send us an email to pets@wpr.org. This is a perfect time for our listeners to jump in to the breach here. We need you.
We sure do. And also tell us how to bathe a ferret, if you can, with your pet tip.
Send videos.
Yeah, because I suppose bathing a ferret would be like bathing a cat.
Well, you
some
know.
Some cats like it and some don't.
I would guess.
And probably same with ferrets.
Well, you know, some dogs aren't so fond of baths either. So, you
no.
know, some kids aren't either, right, Larry?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you got to work on these things, right?
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll talk with a premier animal photographer about her book of photography, Celebrating the New American Mutt. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this week we welcome Amanda Jones to the program. Amanda is an animal photographer based out of North Adams, Massachusetts, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, Sunday Style section. She's been on Good Morning America and on the post-Katrina cover of Bark magazine, and a new book called A Breed Apart, A Celebration of the New American Mutt, features her black and white photography of mixed breed dogs. Amanda, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
How did you get started photographing animals?
Well, my photography business started in 1994 with weddings, not animals. And I photographed a lot of weddings. too many, in fact, where I got to a point where I did not want to photograph them anymore and started looking for a new subject matter, which is when I came across dogs. I did not have a dog at the time, but a very good friend of mine had a yellow lab named Ruby, who I had known since she was a puppy. And I was interested in doing a really nice portrait of her, so I brought her into the studio, and we had this wonderful photo shoot that was a lot of fun that resulted in this beautiful black and white portrait of her. So I took the picture, and I blew it up very, very large, and I gave it to my friend whose dog Ruby was, and he put it on his living room wall where it still sits today, and he just raved and raved about it, and it really connected with me how much that photograph meant to him. And I thought, you know, this might be a fun thing to do, to photograph dogs. And so I started asking all my friends to bring in their dogs. And that's how it all began.
Wow. What? Tell us about your approach now when you're photographing dogs and other animals. What are you looking for when you're deciding what kind of portrait to get?
What I really look for is simplicity. I want to keep the images as pared down as I possibly can, which is one of the reasons why I like to photograph against an all-white background. It really sets the animal off and it kind of separates them from their environment and just focuses on how beautiful they are and what their fur looks like and how expressive their eyes are. So what I really want to try and do is keep it simple and concentrate on who the dog is and his personality.
It's got to be difficult, though, to take great pictures of such unpredictable models. What are your tricks to get dogs to look just right when you photograph them?
Oh, I have a lot of patience. My husband sat through a photo shoot once with dogs, and he said, "I don't know how you do that." So I really, really can wait them out and give them the time they need to really capture kind of what they're about and let them relax in the studio and then get to work on trying to find their essence. And I do talk to the owners a lot about their dogs and what their personalities are and what they mean to them. And I kind of go from there after I get that information.
So and I suppose it takes a long time, or it takes some time, for the dog to get accustomed to you. After all, the animal's in an unfamiliar location or setting, and it's kind of potentially scary.
It can be very scary for dogs, and I actually do have my biggest issue with getting dogs in the studio is putting them in that uncomfortable place where they don't know me. They've never certainly seen the kind of lights that I use before, and, you know, they're strobes, so they pop when I shoot. So it can be a little bit tricky, and I have to work very hard in trying to just make them comfortable. And I do that by keeping my energy level very low and staying low to the ground and, you know, getting down to their level and trying to connect with them that way. And I find it works fairly well. Some dogs are really tricky, but for the most part, we can get an uncomfortable dog comfortable in about 20 minutes.
And, you know, and getting down to their level, I think, is important. And from a, you know, photographs high of a dog low are not nearly as nice as those that are taken kind of at their level.
And especially, I think, at eye level. It's really nice to be able to look straight into their right into their face, and especially their eyes. When I'm photographing a dog, my focus is almost always on their eyes. So that's kind of my focusing point is just their expressive eyes.
You know, speaking of eyes, one of the problems I run into is the eye of the camera. You know, that big, round, black, threatening-looking eye. You know, in dogs, a big, round, black eye is a threat.
Yes.
And so you must have to get around that as well, because you've got, a beautiful big camera.
Yes, I do have a very large camera, and I put it very close into their face. I really like to get close-up shots. It's kind of one of my trademarks, is getting in really tight. And so it's really hard, and I have to take my time and move slowly and really try and get them to trust me. And of course, I, you know, use treats, and that helps quite a bit.
You must have had some hilarious moments when shooting dog pictures. Can you share some of those memories with us?
Oh, I've had some just incredible dogs. If I could, you know, put into a minute synopsis of the size and the variety of dogs that I photographed, it's just incredible. I had an Irish wolfhound in the studio once who almost took up the entire set. I have a 9-foot-wide background roll of paper that I roll down and the dog is out on, and I had to back up about halfway across the room to get them all in the shot. And then, let's see, as far as the little dogs, I've had I had one Yorkie come into the studio who was tennis ball obsessed, of all things, which is not a normal Yorkie trait, but this little Yorkie would just jump for the ball. He would jump, you know, 4 feet in the air, and I just got the most incredible, basically flying Yorkie photographs of him going after his tennis ball, and it was one of the smaller tennis balls, so he could get it in his mouth. And it was just a hilarious shoot. And sometimes I have to put the camera down for a minute and just laugh, you know, just give myself a break and time to enjoy it, because they can be just such fun.
Well, you know, your new book, A Breed Apart, has photographs of what you call the new American mutt. Why did you choose? I'd love to hear more about why you chose to feature mixed breeds in your book.
Well, I had done 3 previous books, and they were all breed specific. I did a book on dachshunds, greyhounds, and French bulldogs. And I realized when I was doing I do a lot of commission portrait sessions for people, and most of the dogs that come in are mixed breed dogs, and some of them are just fascinating mixes of 2 or 3 different breeds. And if you really study the dog, you can see and feel the different characteristics of each breed. So I thought it might be really fun to get some of these dogs in and kind of highlight, like, what makes it kind of half pug and half Italian greyhound, and really show off those interesting combinations, because I found them just fascinating.
And I love one of the things that the book incorporates is they made up names. So the Dachshund Beagle is a Deagle, and the, I think it's a Jack Russell Terrier Poodle Schnauzer is a Jackadauser.
Jackadauser.
And there's a Labrador, a pit bull and a Labrador. I love it.
And we had a very fun lunchtime one day sitting around looking at the photographs and coming up with names. And we were kind of spoofing the whole new mixed breed thing with the Labradoodles and the Puggles. You know, we were kind of going from that and taking their cue. It was very fun.
You mentioned, and I want to go back to it, you mentioned other tricks that you do to get the dogs to and I was thinking about I was thinking about my daughter, who's 4 now, but we've every year take her in for her pictures, and there are little tricks, poppets and so forth, that the photographers use. You mentioned the ball. Are there other tricks that you employ to get the dogs looking just right for those of us who have dogs and want to get the best pictures of them?
Well, I have a very well practiced meow that works wonders for getting the head tilt.
Oh.
And high squeaks, any strange noise that they just haven't quite heard before, you can usually, depending on the dog, get a slight head tilt or very interested, ears up, attention. And then I also search for the best squeaky toys in the pet stores. So I'll go in and test the squeaks to find the real strong ones. And then I hide it behind my back so they can't see it. Because if they see it, they'll come to it. But if you hide it behind your back or in your hand, if it's small enough, they can't see it, so they can't come to it. And they just sit there and kind of look and search for it. So that works really well. Then I also discovered a new one recently, and that's the knock on the table or the floor with a hello, you know, like somebody's at the door.
Right.
And that's
they start barking.
Or they perks their ears, or they give this little real intent look, or they'll do the, you know, the kind of who's there. It's very fun.
And, you know, one thing I've noticed from your books and looking at all your work is You tend to stay away from asking your dog to sit. You know, so many people ask their dog to sit and stay, and they go over them, they take a picture of them, and you don't really get the essence of who the dog is. You know, if you look at most of your pictures, the dog isn't on a sit-stay. The dog is just doing something or hanging out or standing there or moving to the left or moving to the right.
Yeah, I think that if you get them in a sit-stay, they're looking to you for your command or your focus. And if you just give them something to do, let them go and, you know, play with the ball or toss something real different for them that they haven't played with before, and just let them go to town and play with it, and then work on getting the shot, they're much more comfortable and they're much more themselves. I do a thing in the studio where I'll toss treats, and they go and retrieve them and then come back, and I get movement, and I get different sides of their bodies and different shapes that they make, and I find that to work really well.
Do you have a favorite mixed breed combination yourself?
Oh, yes. My favorite in the book is the Dachshund Golden Retriever named Tank from Telluride, Colorado. And he was unlike any dog I had ever seen in my life. He had kind of a Golden Retriever-sized body and a Dachshund shape with short legs and ears that stuck out to the side. I just had never seen anything like him. I forget what we named him, but
Looking right now. Yeah. I can find him fast enough.
he had this beautiful, beautiful, thick Golden Retriever coat, but he was only about probably 2.5 feet off the ground, and he just had this. His name was so perfect for him. He had this solid personality, and he wasn't disturbed by anything. And we just had a really fun photo shoot with him.
A Dachshunder.
A Dachshunder.
Tank. And I'm just paging through. I found another one, a Gordon Setter Border Collie cross called a Better Collie.
Better Collie.
That's really fun.
Yeah.
Amanda, thank you so much. It was a joy talking with you today. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Amanda Jones' work is featured in a new book called A Breed Apart, A Celebration of the New American Mutt. And she joined us from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Amanda's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of A Breed Apart by Amanda Jones. And here's today's question. When it comes to sleep, we've always believed that it's essential for health in all mammals. It's possible that sleep plays an important role in the restoration of a hardworking body, but it turns out that your muscles and organ systems can rest up just as well when you're sleeping as when you're resting on the couch. That is, all of your organs except one. Which organ is it? And I have to think about that for a minute. If you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the correct answer, check our website in about a week. We'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And let's take a call now at 1-800-462-7413. Hi there, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for taking my call. This is Vikas calling from Madison.
Vikas from Madison, Wisconsin?
Yeah.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have two questions for you. We have an 8-month-old Labrador retriever. His name is Mojo.
Mojo.
And he's a very nice dog. Patricia, he's been to two different puppy socialization classes from Dog's Best Friend.
Great.
So that was really, really helpful. So he's a very well-behaved dog. But the question that I have for you is that he's a retriever, but he doesn't chase after balls.
Ah.
We throw the ball a couple of times. He'll go and fetch it, and then third or fourth time, he'll just go away, sit in a corner with the ball and start chewing on that. He's not interested in retrieving it anymore.
And you know that's really common. Don't worry. You'd think a retriever would just start retrieving from sort of the second you brought him home, and there are indeed dogs who do that. Little seven-week-old puppies, it's so endearing. You can throw a little piece of paper, and they'll bring it back and drop it in your lap. There are dogs who do that, but there are lots of dogs who don't, even retrievers. So if he brings it back three times at 8 months, you know what? That's fine. So what you want to do right now is you want to end the game before he ends it. So you end the game. If he brings it back three times, but not the fourth, then you throw it three times, and then you end the game. Take the ball and say, oh, that's enough, no more, too bad. And you might even want to tease him with it a little bit, you know. That works on dogs, too, you know, hard to get. So like, oh, here's the ball. Oh, too bad.
Sorry, you can't have it.
Can't play anymore. I use that phrase, too bad, a lot, and it's really satisfying for you. But it sort of tells him that playtime is over, and it tends to make him want to do it a little bit more the next time. I would expect him to be retrieving fully when he's maybe not even a year and a half.
Oh, okay. So are there any other toys that we could be using for him to retrieve other than just balls? We usually use tennis balls for that.
You know, there are some others. Amusingly, that the favorite retrieving item that I've ever seen actually is convenient to people who live in Wisconsin because it's the dairy state. There's a black rubber tubing that's used when you're collecting milk, that's used to channel the milk through different kinds of tubes into the milk tank when you're milking cows. And it's this, it's about a foot long and it's about an inch wide and it's a soft, squishy black rubber, and they're easy to get if you can sort of find a dairy farmer. They all have a million of them. Dogs love them. They love them, and I don't know why. But so you're in Wisconsin, so you're in good shape. You'll be able to find them.
All right. I'll give it a shot then. And then the second question that I had for you do you have any recommendation for vacuum cleaners? Which vacuum cleaner works the best with pet hair?
Oh, my goodness. No. All I can tell you is that all of my friends who have, first of all, I'm not a vacuum cleaner expert, so I'm sure there's a better answer in terms of which one is better. But here's what my friends and I have all decided. You just have to acknowledge that you have to buy new vacuum cleaners way more often than you think you should. That's what we've all decided. Now, I'm sure, you know, this is a great question for our listeners.
Yeah.
Is please get on our, you know, send us an email. Send us an email at pets@wpr.org if you found a great vacuum cleaner, because boy, could I use that advice. And so could our caller here. We'd love to hear from you.
Thanks a lot for calling, by the way. Tricia Kate in Madison, Wisconsin, wrote in about a problem she's having with her brand-new 8.5-year-old German Shepherd Golden Retriever mix named Greta, and here's what she writes. We adopted Greta about 4 months ago. She's very affectionate, gentle, rarely barks. She's fine being left alone for a full workday. But in the last 2 to 3 weeks, she started opening doors and letting herself out into the yard during the day.
Dear.
At first, she was just opening our sliding screen door, even though it was locked. So we closed and locked the heavy sliding glass door as well. Well, she figured out how to flip that lock lever, too. We tried putting a prickly mat on the floor in front of the door, and we put a broom handle in the sliding door to prevent her from opening it. She's already pushed the mat aside and taken large chunks of wood out of the broom handle and the door frame. We tried crating her, but doing so caused her to have projectile diarrhea.
Oh, dear.
We haven't had Greta for very long, but we do know that she used to be an outside dog at her old home, and she wasn't very happy. She hates going outside when we're home. It's as if she's scared we won't let her back in again. We hope you might be able to tackle this problem. We'd really appreciate some insight and suggestions.
It sounds as though, let's think about what you said here, is if she doesn't like to be outside when you're home, and she tries to get outside when you're gone, she's trying to get to you, don't you think?
I think this is a classic symptom
of separation anxiety. I think you have a dog with separation anxiety. The big overall picture of separation anxiety, I can go over very fast, and I will in a second, but really to get the details, I want you to go online. There are books out there on how to treat it. I've written ones. Other people have written other good ones. But the idea is basically to start teaching her that the signs of your going do not lead to her feeling fearful. They lead to her feeling pretty good about something. So figure out what she loves. And food is very helpful in this circumstance because you can take, for example, you can get a hollow toy, stuff it with really good food, canned dog food, chicken, something really wonderful. But here's the trick. If you just put it down and then leave the house for 5 minutes, she might not touch it because she's going to be too anxious. You know, 5 minutes is a really long time if you're scared. So what you need to do is start earlier than that. Start by just putting your coat on and then giving her this Kong and then sit down on the couch. I mean, you don't even walk to the door. Just walking to the door is a trigger to a lot of dogs. So you're just going to start by picking up your keys, giving her this Kong. So she gets used to like, oh, I don't care if they pick up their keys. It leads to something good. And then I don't care if they pick up their keys and put on their jacket because that's going to lead to me getting this great food and they're not actually going to leave, so I'm not going to be scared. And then you gradually build on that. It takes about 6 to 8 weeks. You spend the most time in the early parts. You literally spent the first half on just being able to get to the door and walk outside for a minute. Really. Mm-hmm. But once you've got a minute, you know, it's that first time that's the problem. Think about, for parents, think about when you left your kid at daycare or at kindergarten or with a sitter and the sitter, you know, and they're screaming and crying. You think, you know, this is horrible. I can't leave my poor child. And the sitter says, oh, the second you drove away, they were fine. You know, it's that actual separation that's the hardest. So work the longest on that. But that's how I would treat this particular issue.
Just one little follow-up to that. When you're first starting and let's say you put that down and the dog sits down and then you get up, you take that away then.
Yeah, you do, Larry, you do. So say you pick up your keys, put on your jacket, give the dog this Kong or whatever it is, sit down on the couch, and then you just let him start getting really into it. Maybe 20 seconds, and then you pick it up, take it away before they're done. Yeah, so good detail to add in there.
And how can people email us?
Oh, please send us emails. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And call us at 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, Patricia, Larry. This is Mike calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I have a question, comment about fat cats and thin cats. I've had many cats over my lifetime, and most of them are thin. However, I have some acquaintances that have numbers of cats, and most of them are fat, rather chunky. Now, my cats have always had dry food out at all times in unlimited quantities. In fact, sometimes I'll have up to 3 flavors of dry foods. And they seem to have the attitude that, well, there's food there all the time. We don't have to eat it all. Whereas some of my friends, I think, because they only feed a limited amount and they have multiple cats, the cats seem to think, well, there's food there. We have to eat it all now because we don't know when the next meal will be there.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this of dogs, that dogs will eat everything in front of them. Now, what are your feelings on this?
It depends. That's the best answer to most questions in relation to animal behavior. Is it depends. You know, there are some animals that really do self-regulate. Dogs and cats, you leave food out continuously all the time, and it's the same food. And frankly, part of it is like it's the same food. And it's like, you know, it's like how exciting is that? So they eat when they're hungry. They don't eat, you know, like we're supposed to do. We're supposed to only eat when we're hungry, right? So, you know, that's when they eat. And there's some individuals who do really well with that, but there are others who just can't pass up the buffet. You know, they just can't. And so one of the problems with having multiple animals, say you have 5 cats, and 3 of them would be great that way, but the other 2 wouldn't. They just keep eating until they're really, really fat. You know, there's a huge individual variance in how animals respond to different levels of food. Obviously, you know, it's all about calories in and calories out. But the details relate to your genetics, to how likely is your body to convert something to fat, to how does the satiety center in your brain work, you know? Some of us are just sort of never satisfied, and some people are like, oh, I don't really care about food that much. So there are indeed huge individual differences.
Sure. Do you think it has anything to do with whether these cats are raised from kittens in a group or by themselves, and if they are raised just as 2 cats in a household and they have unlimited food all the time, do you think that has any influence on it?
I think that's a very good observation. I don't know which way it necessarily is going to go, because it depends on the, again, it depends, back to that, depends on the group. But you are absolutely right that social factors, you know, there's a social facilitation aspect of eating. And, you know, we humans understand it, too. It's sort of a very social event. And there's also a little bit of competition. Well, I wasn't really hungry, but look at him eating that hamburger over there. Maybe I want a hamburger, too, you know. Or he's getting the hamburger and I'm not. So I think competition can come into it and a little bit of social facilitation. So that's a very good point. But again, it so much depends on which individuals are in the mix.
And, you know, in the dairy industry now, yes, large dairy herds, the feeding is computerized, and the animals wear a little chain with a computer chip.
That's right.
On their, around their neck, and when they go up to the feed bin, the computer recognizes that chip and serves out a portion of food based on that animal's history. I suppose we could do it if you had five kitties.
Yeah, and $30,000,
$40,000. $30,000, $40,000.
Get that system implemented in your house. I have no idea how much it is, but it's a lot, let me tell you.
It's a lot of money. But it's one way to solve the problem.
That's, Larry comes up with yet another way.
Throw money at it, I say.
That's it, the American way, Mueller.
And the American way is that we return every single week. Patricia, thank you so much.
We're so patriotic.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0915P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, we'll tell you how to keep your pet safe during an emergency.
And we'll welcome an author and radio personality who'll talk about the recent Michael Vick scandal and the true victims of dogfighting.
Tune in for that and more of your animal behavior questions on the very next Calling All Pets.